It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Construction has finished on a new floating pier off the Gaza Strip to allow critical aid to flow into Palestine as the war in Gaza continues.
The U.S. military's pier project is an important step in bringing much-needed supplies to Palestinians who have been facing starvation. But humanitarian aid groups say it's not enough.
Last month, a group of ships called the Gaza Freedom Flotilla tried to enter Palestine with over 5,000 tons of supplies, but were turned away after the nation of Guinea-Bissau removed its flags from the ships.
Organizers say Israel is to blame for putting pressure on the government. The president of Guinea-Bissau denies that.
Cassandra Dixon is a Wisconsin activist who was part of the flotilla and is a member of the Madison Rafa Sister City Project. She's volunteered in the West Bank for nearly 20 years. I talked with her recently and asked her about those ships and what they were carrying. Can you describe this group of ships that attempted to reach the Gaza Strip?
Sure. These ships were organized by the Freedom Flotilla. They were a civilian mission, an attempt to bring 5,500 tons of really desperately needed aid to Gaza. So it included people from more than 30 countries who would have been aboard a passenger ship accompanying that larger aid ship. We were hoping to sail from Istanbul. So all of us spent a week, 10 days, depending on when we arrived, waiting for and hoping that we would be able to do that. In the end, we were not able to. And we're waiting now. We're all back in our home countries, but very much hoping that we'll be able to try again.
So this aid ship was all of these, the humanitarian aid was loaded in Turkey, in Istanbul. Is that right?
Yes, right. The aid ship itself is loaded with medicine and food and water and other really, really needed aid and had already undergone multiple inspections and was ready to go. And we really thought the next day that all of the various problems had been cleared and that we would be able to get on there onto the passenger ships and sail with it. But in the end, it didn't happen. We believe that Israel was able to pressure. It was the government of Guinea-Bissau. It was Guinea-Bissau that had flagged the ships, their international ships registry. And it's really almost unheard of for a country to withdraw flags, but that happened.
Guinea-Bissau in Western Africa. And one of the demands that I understand is they wanted a manifest of your cargo. Was that unreasonable?
I mean, no, that particular demand is not unreasonable. And the ship had already undergone two complete inspections of that cargo. So, I mean, not only was there a manifest of the cargo, but there were eyes on it multiple times. And then Guinea-Bissau itself was in the midst of a third inspection of that same cargo, but they didn't finish the inspection. And they also did not find anything wrong with the cargo. They didn't state that as a reason for pulling the flag.
So what happens to all this water and medicine and supplies with these ships unable to sail?
The aid agency from Turkey that was involved in putting together the aid will try to get that particular aid through Egypt. There are thousands of trucks waiting now at the border crossing, hoping to bring aid in, and this will just be more aid in that line now. If we are able to resolve the flagging issue and able to go again, then we will replace that aid. But in the meantime, it itself will be in line there. The problem is that I watched videos yesterday of truck drivers just begging the world to put pressure on Israel to open that border crossing to the aid trucks because some of them have perishable aid on them that is indeed perishing right now. And it's additionally heartbreaking because it's just minutes, 10 minutes away from people who are actually starving in need of that food right now.
Meanwhile, the U.S. military has opened this floating pier that's been installed to be able to be a route into the Gaza Strip. Would that have been helpful for the flotilla?
I believe myself that that's a huge distraction. There are thousands of trucks lined up minutes away from the people who need that aid. They are operated by agencies who deal with aid all the time. That's what they do. They are well set up to deliver it. They have people inside of Gaza waiting to distribute that aid. So if there was a sincere longing to allow aid in, what we would do is insist that the Rafah border crossing be opened.
How has Israel's blockade affected efforts to bring humanitarian aid into Palestine? What have you seen?
Well, I think that we're all seeing, and certainly in the steps that they took to prevent this one ship, they're very determined to blockade, to sustain a blockade of Gaza. So Gaza is a tiny place. It's 25 miles long, and at its very widest point, it's 7 miles. So here in Wisconsin, that would fit between Madison and Baraboo in a narrow strip that 7 miles is a tiny width. So it's been the world's largest open-air prison since Israel instituted this blockade 16 years ago. And the problems since October 7th obviously have been much, much worse. So much of Gaza has been bombed and the food supply is completely destroyed. But even before that, some of the items that were not allowed in by Israel included wheelchair parts and chips and various toys, foods of all kinds. People were limited to 1,100 calories a day based on the amount that was allowed in. So this has been a stranglehold on the people of Gaza for many, many years, and has also completely prevented them from having any kind of independent international commerce. They're not able to import or export anything of their own. It's hard to imagine a country sustaining life like that.
Israel argues that the naval blockade is justified to prevent weapons from entering Gaza and getting into the hands of Hamas and other militant groups. Do you think that that is warranted?
Well, that certainly was not the case with the ship that we were trying to sail in. There were no weapons on that ship. It had gone through two complete inspections and was well on the way through a third, which absolutely proved that there was nothing on there that needed to be of any concern to anyone. So in this instance, definitely, this was definitely a ship with no weapons that had only desperately needed humanitarian aid that was blocked from coming in. And I think that the same is true for the trucks that are lined up at the border crossing now. Oranges and flour and apples, and there are not weapons in those food trucks, and yet there are masses of them being blocked. When you look at these videos, it's miles of blocked trucks.
We're talking about Wisconsin-based efforts to bring aid to Palestine with Cassandra Dixon with us, a member of the Madison Rafah Sister City Project, and we've been learning about her recent efforts to bring supplies into the area as part of the Gaza Freedom Coalition. Cassandra, explain for us as well your connection to the Madison Rafah Sister City Project and what this organization does.
Right. Well, Madison Rafah Sister City Project started originally. They hoped to become an official sister city with Rafah, and they were not able to do that. However, they have remained an active project. We have funded a number of humanitarian projects in the city of Rafah, the area of Rafah, over the years, including water filters and school projects, mental health programs for children, school supplies. We've had a long relationship with several organizations there that provide jobs for people through making crafts, so soap and embroidered crafts that we have brought to Madison and sold, and had a revolving craft account where we would purchase what we could and resell it, and then with the money that came back, just repurchase that, so that people who are living in this situation of an embargo there, of a blockade, and are so challenged by not being able to sell their products easily, would have access to a Madison market to sell those things.
Has Madison faced obstacles in its sister city relationship to Rafah?
Well, the most devastating for us and also for Rafah has been that we have not been able to visit, and people from Rafah have not been able to visit here, because Israel so tightly controls who can go in and out of Gaza. In fact, Representative Mark Pocan tried very hard to visit Gaza himself and has long been a proponent of this sister city relationship and enthusiastic about it and wanted to visit himself and was not allowed in. So that has definitely been a difficult thing in maintaining that relationship. Most sister cities are able to have cultural exchanges between the two, have students come back and forth, and that we've not been able to do. And also, sadly, at this point, all of the humanitarian things that we've funded over the years have been destroyed.
Hmm. Returning now to the Gaza Strip, and you personally, do you have plans to try to go back and be part of this type of activism?
Well, we very much hope that we will be able to sail a boat with the equivalent amount of aid to Gaza in the coming weeks. The planners are searching for a country that's brave enough to flag a ship. And we very, very much hope that we will be able to complete this citizen initiative to bring aid. It's not just the U.S. involved here. There were people from more than 30 countries. And all of those people have been doing all that we can throughout this time to raise awareness of the genocide that is happening in Gaza. And many of us had been involved with understanding the occupation even, you know, long before October 7th. And so we're very much hoping that we'll be able to try again and that a way will open for citizens to deliver this desperately needed aid.
Cassandra, thank you so much for joining us and thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for having me.
Cassandra Dixon is a carpenter based in Madison and a member of the Madison Rafa Sister City Project. We've been talking about her years of humanitarian aid work in Palestine and her recent efforts to bring supplies into the Gaza Strip as part of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla.
Coming up, Wisconsin regulations on the alcohol industry got a big overhaul. A lot of the changes kicked off this month. Find out what's changing and why some business owners are still confused about the new guidelines. That's coming up on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin passed a law last year to update how it regulates the alcohol industry. It's a pretty big deal.
The bill was signed into law last December, but most of the changes just went into effect on May 1st.
The updated law replaces the previous regulations known as the three-tiered system of producers, distributors, and retailers in the state. It opens up additional opportunities for those businesses.
Some companies in the industry have been quick to take up the changes, while others have had more trouble figuring out exactly how this will impact their operations.
We're checking in on how the new alcohol regulations are affecting the industry and what it means for us as consumers. Let's start with the world of Wisconsin wines. Sean Lepasek is the owner and winemaker at Rock and Wool Winery in Poinette. Sean, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
My pleasure.
I understand there's been some confusion at different businesses about what exactly these new regulations mean, including for wineries like yours, when, how they go into effect. What kind of issues are you running into so far?
Well, there's a whole lot of them. Number one, even the lawyers for like Wisconsin Wine Association, and they're very good. We had a meeting about a month and a half ago, and everything they said was, well, maybe. We're not sure. Maybe. We're not sure. And no one really knew when the laws were going to go into effect, when we'd be alerted to them, or how it would affect the township. The biggest thing is, for me, all my licensing comes from Decorah Township, and that has to be done by June. Well, you know, we just got something middle of May saying, okay, well, you should apply for this. We're not really sure. Are we going to be licensed in the meantime? When are we going to receive this license? You know, questions like that, they don't really work well with the business because I can't plan events. I can't tell people, okay, we'll have this license now. I can serve this and this and this. There's just no, and Decorah, the township, they're not aware of anything. They had a meeting, but most of the secretaries, treasurers, they're still not sure what's going on or how to deal with us or what to expect from us.
As this process was going on, Sean, and this law was taking shape, were there specific things that you were hoping, like, yeah, I hope we can do this at the winery under these new laws? Were there things, opportunities that you were hoping for?
For us, not that we want to stay open till bar time, but it would be nice, you know, to not have a 9 o'clock curfew on our place, especially if we're doing an event or if we're having a wedding or a party or something like that. So I think that was the biggest thing, that we could extend our hours. Also, the ability to be able to serve hard alcohol is really beneficial for us. It allows us to keep competing with a lot of the other places that are opening up, and also offers, look, women love wine. Guys will prefer beer or bourbon. So to have other avenues that we can say, okay, ladies, you can bring your husband here. We've got something to make them happy too. That's just very beneficial for us.
Now, we've been talking about some of the confusion. Now that this new law is in effect, did you feel like, you know, before this law took effect, there were some gray areas that kept you from doing some of the business moves you'd want to do?
Well, not so much. I mean, the hours mm-hmm. was tough for us. And then the gray area would be like, okay, well, somebody wants to have a wedding here and they're renting space from us. Does that mean we still have to close at 9, or is somebody renting our space from us and they're able to have a private party there? So that's always been a gray area.
Well, and if I'm hearing you right, Sean, part of the story here is, okay, there's the law, and then there's business people like yourself, but then there's the local government who actually has to issue you licenses. Do you feel like that communication needs to be improved to make sure, you know, all three of those parts are in sync with each other?
100%. I've got a great relationship with Decorah Township. I know the people on the board. They're good people. They promote our business. So right off the bat, this law says, okay, well, your main license now are just coming from the state. And that's okay. But all of a sudden, Decorah's like, what? You're not paying us for this license anymore? And like, yeah, well, it's not me doing that. This is the state doing it. So that's where the communication really needs to be a little bit better. Let the state know, you know, okay, this winery is not trying to shut you out. This is just the way the law reads. And, you know, we don't want to bruise anybody's feelings or anything like that. We, you know, the state can make a law, but we still have to conduct business within this township.
And Sean, as we wrap up, do you feel like for the most part you can still do the basics, keep making wine and selling it to your customers?
Oh, yes. And nothing so far has impeded anything like that. I guess for me, it's just like, you're telling me we can do things, but we don't know when we can, so I can't promote my business in a manner. And I guess that's what's tough. I kind of feel like I still have handcuffs on. But for making the wine and going as we have been, I feel fine. I mean, I don't believe that if the state drops the ball and they don't get me a license before my one with the township expires, that they're going to come down and say, hey, you've been practicing without a license. That'd be a whole nother story if that were to happen.
I bet. Sean, thank you so much for joining us today.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for caring about this issue.
Sean Lapasik is a winemaker and owner of Rock and Wool Winery in Poinette. He was with us today to talk about how updated alcohol laws in Wisconsin are affecting his business and his industry. Sean is not the only Wisconsin alcohol producer who's having issues navigating those new regulations. Now we turn to an expert who advises businesses around the state on the legal landscape of food and beverages. Jeff Glazer is an attorney for Ogden, Glazer, and Schaefer in Madison, where he works with breweries, wineries, and distilleries. Jeff, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. This law passed year changes a lot of stuff in the world of alcohol in Wisconsin. What do you see as the ones that are going to affect businesses in the state the most?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest impact that we're going to see here is going to be with the producers, with the manufacturers, with the breweries, wineries, distilleries, cideries, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So my impression is, and correct me if I'm wrong, some of the things that are now legal is stuff that a lot of those were sort of starting to do in legal gray areas before this.
Yeah, one of the problems that we'd had, I've been doing this since 2007, and when I first started, the industry was very sort of traditional. You made a product, you sold it to a wholesaler, the wholesaler carried it off to a retailer, and then the retailer sold it for you. And that's just not what the industry looks like anymore. And so this makes it a lot, it sort of modernizes the law to make it easier for small manufacturers to compete.
Right. So if I am a brewer, say, and I've been making my beer for a while, selling it maybe in my tap room, on tap only or whatever, what changes for me now?
Yeah, well, for example, if you were a brewer, one of the things that you were making was probably a hard seltzer, because over the last few years, that's become a very popular product. It wasn't entirely clear whether you were allowed to make that product because the law did not account for things like hard seltzers. And so we thought the answer was one thing and maybe the answer was a different thing. But this law clarifies that and makes it a whole lot easier for you as a brewery to have some certainty about the things that you're doing.
And that reminds me, one of the things, one of the parts of this, as I understand it, is, hey, I have a distillery, say, and I want to make an old-fashioned prepackaged.
Yeah.
And I want to serve that here. Before, I maybe could or couldn't do that, or I wouldn't know. Now I can.
Yeah.
Probably.
True. Yeah. Yeah. There are sort of a lot of things that we all know were happening that may have been, if you
wink,
if you read the rules, may have been technically not permitted. And it made for a hard enforcement environment because one person would get busted, but then there'd still be 800 people who were still doing that thing. And it made for a difficult enforcement environment. It made for very, very unpredictable, it made it hard to try to predict whether you were going to get in trouble for the things that you were doing.
We're talking about big changes in Wisconsin's alcohol regulations with attorney Jeff Glazer from Ogden, Glazer & Schaefer. He's been in this line of work for a good long time now. Jeff, for a consumer, somebody goes to the grocery store to buy some beer or the liquor store to buy some wine or whatever, in a lot of ways, we're not going to see this stuff, right?
Not necessarily at the grocery store. Where you may notice it is if you wander into your local craft manufacturer and that distillery, cidery, winery, brewery. We hear from a lot of breweries, hey, I'd love to be able to just serve a glass of wine to folks. But that's all under the old law was an entirely different permit that you weren't even allowed to hold. And now you can serve a glass of wine if you would like. And, somewhat more oddly, breweries couldn't serve wine or distilled spirits. Wineries could serve beer, but not distilled spirits. Distilleries could serve their own distilled spirits and wine and beer. And so each of the different manufacturers had these like really arcane, confusing rules around what they were allowed to serve. All of that has gone away. Everybody can serve everything now. And it'll make the tasting rooms just a much more comfortable place for consumers.
Seems like most parties are happy or at least content with what came out of this, except wedding barns or event locations that used to serve alcohol. They didn't necessarily have what we would consider a liquor license. A lot of people in the industry not happy about that. Where are we with those? And there's a lot of these. Where are we with these facilities?
Yeah, the wedding barns have sort of been in the crosshairs for a long time. I mean, this is not news to anybody in the industry. The Department of Revenue has long been looking at wedding barns and what to do about them. But we have a situation now where wedding barns are being told they have to get local liquor licenses in order to continue operating in the way that they had been. There's now a lawsuit that's suing the state over this law from the wedding barns. We'll see where that goes. Personally, I don't know that that's going to go very far. And I think we're going to be in a universe where wedding barns are going to have to get local licenses in order to have alcohol in their spaces.
Another part of the story here is contract brewing or distilling. Now, I sometimes see when I get a whiskey from another state and I look online about it, well, this is produced at the same place as 20 other brands of whiskey. What changes for contract brewing and distilling here in Wisconsin now?
Yeah, this is sort of one of the dirty little secrets of the industry, which is particularly in spirits, largely in wine, and increasingly in beer. The product that's in your glass is probably manufactured by somebody other than the brand name that's on the front of the package. And in Wisconsin, contract manufacturing for beer was fine. Everybody sort of knew what the rules were. For wine and spirits, it was a little more challenging of an environment. And so this law brings wine and spirits into harmony with beer contract manufacturing. And so now all contract manufacturing is allowed, which is a benefit to Wisconsin. We're one of the biggest manufacturers of contract alcohol in the state, or in the country rather. And so this is going to be good business for the state of Wisconsin.
As we wrap up, Jeff, do you have a big open question about these changes that we don't know the answer to yet?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, in the spaces, there's a whole bunch of unanswered questions. But I think by and large, it's all still very new. And so I think we're waiting to see who the people are that are going to be appointed into these positions in order to be able to better understand that. Right now, a lot of the enforcement agents are going to change. And so the people who are coming in and out of your brewery, winery, distillery are going to be completely new people. Those are going to be new relationships that you're going to have to form. Those are going to be new answers that you're going to have to get. So I think everybody's just still sort of waiting to see how those play out.
Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jeff Glazer is an attorney who specializes in the food and beverage industry for Ogden, Glazer, and Schaefer in Madison. He was with us today to help clarify Wisconsin's new alcohol regulations, many of which went into effect on May 1st. Some businesses in the alcohol industry have embraced these changes and started taking advantage of them from the get-go. Distilleries used to be barred from serving any alcohol they did not make themselves. State Line Distillery in Madison produces 9 spirits of their own, but now they've already started mixing in some types of alcohol that they don't make into cocktails for the first time. Mike McDonald is the bar manager at State Line Distillery and also the proprietor of Wisco Ice Co., which supplies clear ice to bars around southern Wisconsin. Mike, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Happy to be here.
How are these changes in Wisconsin's alcohol law affecting how you do business at State Line?
So greatly. As we began to enter the distillery space, we wanted to make sure that we were able to craft really great cocktails. And one of the factors in that was that we could only sell and use the products that we produce in our cocktails. So it was a great challenge and really kept our bar unique to other bars around town, but also prevented us from kind of showcasing our spirits the way that a normal bar or cocktail bar would. With those other modifiers and ingredients.
So what do these changes now open up the door for? What kind of cocktail creativity does this allow you to do?
So for me, from the classical cocktail background, it's all of the modifiers that you see, you know, at normal cocktail bars, like the liqueurs in particular. So, you know, your chartreuses, your Luxardo Maraschinos, your Falernums, things like that, that really help you add different flavor profiles to cocktails. And still focusing on our, you know, beautiful spirits here at State Line.
So these laws were kicking in on May 1st. Did you approach this as like, okay, we are sort of reinventing ourselves with these new opportunities?
No, we didn't really want to reinvent ourselves. We wanted to ensure that people could still come to State Line and have unique State Line distillery cocktails. But we also wanted the opportunity to use the ingredients that everyone else is familiar with, you know, that all those classic cocktails that we just couldn't serve because we couldn't carry these products are now available to us. So, you know, we now have a Hemingway Daiquiri, we have a French 75 because we couldn't use sparkling wine before. So all these classic cocktails that you would see at any cocktail bar around the world are now open to us.
Were there things in this long process of rewriting these laws that you were hoping to see happen apart from the main thing we've been talking about, having being able to bring in alcohol produced by other producers?
Sure. Well, we definitely were seeing a gap in offerings at like different festivals and markets and things of that nature that spirits were omitted from. So you could get cider, beer, or wine at these, you know, summer festivals, but we were not able to participate even with like cocktails or keg cocktails or anything of that nature. Just our manufacturing license didn't allow us to do that. So that's something that we're going to be looking into this coming summer. And then also just doing other collaborations with other spirit producers. So in particular, we already have a plan to do a farm dinner with J. Henry, a pop-up here with J. Henry. Like using other local distillers in our space was not an option before, and now it is.
We've heard from some other producers, including a winery, where they're kind of confused and there's a lot some gray area in these new laws that they're not sure about yet. Are you seeing any of that yourself?
There's definitely a lot of that. There's a lot of unknowns. I'm sure there will be some adjustments to the regulations or, you know, how they're implemented or how they're interpreted. But as far as we understand it and need to understand it, it's just that we're allowed to, you know, buy directly from a distributor and get those products that we couldn't before.
What are some of your open questions about how these new laws are going to affect your business and that of your colleagues around the state?
So for us, we're just kind of interested in seeing how expanding our options affects the regulars that come here to, you know, the way that people have understood our cocktail menu for the past 7 years has been in this particular way. So we're excited to see like what this change does and if people are attracted to the fact that we can technically now be more like any other cocktail bar around the world and how people react to that.
Mike, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Mike McDonald is the bar manager at State Line Distillery in Madison. He was with us today to share how his company is adapting to changes in Wisconsin's alcohol laws. Those went into effect on May 1st. Earlier, we talked to a Wisconsin winemaker and an attorney about some of the confusion around the new regulations, clarifying what is and isn't allowed.
Coming up, this holiday weekend marks the kickoff for camping season in Wisconsin. We explore some hidden gems and find out what to do when you can't find that last-minute campsite. That's next on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With winter in the rearview mirror, you might be ready to dust off that tent and find some quality sticks for roasting marshmallows.
Wisconsin is kicking off its popular camping season, and it's gotten more popular lately with a big jump in camping reservations after the first year of COVID.
Our next guest has advice for campers, including some lesser-known state campground gems and what to do if you're scrambling for a last-minute campsite.
Missy Van Landit is the Recreation Partnerships Section Chief for the Department of Natural Resources. Missy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's camping season for real. What kind of demand are you seeing and expecting for the remainder of this camping season?
Well, we are seeing pretty significant demand. You know, that was one of those things that while there was a little brief dip in 2022, it's still continuing to rise, which is incredible. For Memorial Weekend, we're actually 88% booked across the system. But so that's incredibly high numbers, but that also means that there is still camping available primarily at the Northern Highland American Legion, which is exciting. It's property that I love. And we're about 72% booked for the summer. But again, so many sites still available. And we have a new cancellation policy available. So you can actually get signed up through email. You can put your site parameters in, and if there's a cancellation, you'll get notified of that and then can go in and work to book that site.
Now, camping has always been popular here in Wisconsin, but as I understand, at least anecdotally, I've heard, Missy, starting with the COVID era, it really took off. Is that right? Have we seen an even bigger increase in our interest in camping?
We did, certainly. So in 2021 was actually bigger, primarily because in 2020, we did shut down our system for a couple of months. But in 2021, you know, folks were still not really traveling out of the state and not doing other things and really still working to be outside. So in 2021, we saw about a 22% increase in the number of bookings and about a 27% increase in the actual number of camping nights that were recorded for the full calendar year. We've dropped a little bit since there, since then, but the numbers continue to climb year after year. We saw the dip in 2022, but that's continuing to increase for 2023, and we're expecting that to increase again in 2024.
I want you to talk directly to that prospective camper who looks and says, oh, my favorite site at, say, Devil's Lake that weekend I want to go. Well, that's full, so maybe I won't go camping. What would you suggest to them for plans B and C?
Well, you know, I'm that person that, for me, for example, I don't have a site booked yet for Memorial Day, but we have plans to go camping. So I look for the cancellations. So if you can be prepared for the cancellations or get on that email notification list, I think that's a great way to do it. I always tell people, though, think about places that you are new to you that you want to explore. So maybe your favorite site at Devil's Lake or Peninsula or Willow River is booked up, but maybe it's not at Perot or Council Grounds or Wyalusing. So there's so much to enjoy across the system at our state parks and state forests that you really can't go wrong with sitting around a campfire, enjoying some hiking or some bicycling, and just being outside. So find a place that might be new to you and explore that instead of some of the more popular places.
The Department of Natural Resources says it's committed to giving outdoor opportunities to people of all abilities. What kind of things are out there when it comes to accessibility for campground facilities around the state?
So we actually have a number of accessible cabins across the state that can be booked, and those generally start booking in January for that same year. But we're really excited to share that we've been adding outdoor adaptive equipment to many of our properties across the state. So even if you're there camping on one of our accessible campsites or in an accessible cabin, there's a lot of infrastructure out there now for folks to explore that are accessible to everyone, regardless of your ability. Things like accessible trails or fishing piers. We have a number of different types of adaptive equipment, including adaptive kayaks, all-terrain wheelchairs, and beach wheelchairs as well.
Is this something that's a growth opportunity as you see it?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that we could potentially be looking at in future budgets is additional accessible cabins, for sure. Our partnership groups, like our friends groups across the state, are currently fundraising for more and more adaptive equipment. You know, we have adaptive kayaks at about 10 or 12 sites right now, with more on the horizon, and also the all-terrain wheelchairs. So those all-terrain wheelchairs there's different models out there, but we have them at about 5 or 6 properties, and that's going to continue to grow as especially our friends groups and partner groups fundraise for those and then help facilitate the checkout of those. So those are all free to use across the system on a checkout basis.
We're talking about Wisconsin camping with Missy Van Landit, Recreation Partnerships Section Chief at the Department of Natural Resources. Missy, I know there's a wide range of amenities. Some places have running water that just got turned on. Some are more and more rustic. Can you talk about the range of options for how much people want to rough it when they go camping?
Yeah. So our primary, you know, the most number of our sites are primarily the family sites. And so those are your typical back-in sites or even some pull-through, and the basic amenities are the campsite is within a campground. It generally has a picnic table, some kind of camping pad that for accessible sites that might be paved, for other sites that might be a gravel pad or even an earth pad, and then a fire ring. So that's kind of the majority of the type of sites. But then we have group sites across the system as well, which range from anywhere from 20 to 50 individuals and a number of tents. And then we also have some of our quiet campgrounds, which I love, like Straight Lake State Park, where those campgrounds you cannot drive to. So you can park in the parking lot, but the campsite you actually have to walk to down a trail. And there's a little bit more space in between those campsites. They still tend to have a picnic table and fire ring, but you have to walk to them. So those those are referred to as our hike-in sites. And then we actually have a number of properties, especially on some of our northern wild river properties and flowages, where you can only access those campsites by water. And many of those campsites are first come, first serve, or are free to reserve.
Speaking of Strait Lake State Park, I saw in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, they said last year Strait Lake had the fewest reservations of any state park. Could you make some suggestions, give some inspiration so that Strait Lake doesn't feel so lonely this year?
Yeah. You know, I love Strait Lake State Park. Look, in West Central Wisconsin, for those that don't know where that is, it's outside of Luck, Wisconsin. Those, all of those sites have water view of Strait Lake State Park. They're all very heavily wooded. And like I said, they're separate from one another. So there's a little bit of space in between those sites and you're not right up on your neighbor. What I love about Strait Lake is there's actually two lakes there, Strait Lake and Rainbow Lake. You can carry in your kayak or canoe and paddle the lake. I had a really magical experience there. When that park was first developed, I was going to go paddling there and it was a weeknight. It was in the fall where the water temperature was warmer than the air, so the steam was coming off the lake. There's a little island in the middle of Strait Lake where there was an eagle nest at the time, and it was one of those gorgeous red sunsets. The eagle was landing in its nest, and I was paddling on that lake. Wow. So it's an incredibly amazing, quiet experience. And if you're into hiking, many folks that hike the Ice Age National Scenic Trail will tell you that the segment that goes through Strait Lake State Park is one of the most gorgeous segments along the entire route.
And we're, I think, talking about one of your favorite subjects here, some of the hidden gems of our state park system. What are some other hidden gem campsite that you wish more people knew about?
Well, you know, I'll talk a little bit about the Northern Highland American Legion. Primarily, you know, when folks ask me, what is your favorite property? That's definitely, I mean, all of them are my favorites, of course, but that's definitely in my top five. And that's primarily where most of the campsite availability is for Memorial Weekend, as well as 4th of July and Labor Day. So I'll talk a little bit about Northern Highland. What I love about that property is you can get a variety of campsites there. You can get very wooded views. You can get water views. You can get more active campgrounds and more rustic campgrounds. And there are thousands of sites at the Northern Highland, which is amazing. But there's also complete recreation at the Northern Highland American Legion State Forest. You're talking over 230,000 acres of forest and over 900 lakes, plus a 52-mile paved bike trail and countless beaches and fishing opportunities. So I love that property for the camping. I love it for the recreation. And it's obviously you're getting up into the Northwoods, but yet you can still find modern amenities just 30 minutes away in the Minocqua area.
I wonder, generally everybody's working for the weekend, right? And we're planning our weekend camping trips. If we are able to finagle our work schedule, does a weekday camping outing open up a lot of doors, a lot of campsites that might not be open on those weekends?
Absolutely. You know, if you're willing to do especially a non-electric site, and especially during the week, you'll have countless opportunities. I don't know the number quite off the top of my head, but historically, our weekday non-electric sites are generally between 50 and 60% booked throughout the summer. So there's definitely a lot more availability there. You might even find some availability at your favorites like Devil's Lake or Peninsula or the Kettle Moraine State Forest. So that can definitely open up. There is also, you know, if you need to work, there's open air shelters. There's a lot of communities close by where you can get Wi-Fi at the local library, things like that. So if you can work remote and camp during the week, that's a great opportunity.
Speaking of potentially longer visits, I know people might want to say, hey, I want to camp for 2 weeks in one site and really settle in here. What are some of the best options for those longer term stays?
You know, most of the longer term stays, I would say, are kind of booked up at 11 months in advance, which is when you can book those. Any property is a great place to do that. Some of the more complete properties like Peninsula State Park or Willow River or the Northern Highland or the Kettles, where you can really dive into a variety of events, different areas of the properties, just because they span more acreage and more recreation opportunities. Also, these are, you know, all of our properties are situated in wonderful communities, some of which the Ice Age National Scenic Trail passes through, but so many great restaurants to check out and other amenities in the area. So, you know, I always recommend those more expansive properties for those 1 or 2 week camping vacations, just because there's such a variety of outdoor recreation things to do. And you can also experience a lot of different events and naturalist programs across those properties during the week, too.
Well, let's talk about an impulse camping experience. Say it's, mid-July, and my weekend plans fell through. Hey, I can suddenly go camping. What are my best bets to be able to snag a site, you know, day of potentially? Or is that possible?
Oh, that's certainly possible. You can book sites day of. People are always canceling. Two recommendations I have. There is non-DNR associated Facebook group. And sometimes those folks will put on there that they're canceling and they'll tell you what time they're going to cancel and where. And you can jump into the reservation system and get a site. So that seems to work for some people. Otherwise, getting on the cancellation notification email is a great way to do that. I would say, though, you know, for myself, if you're willing to go, you know, within 2 hours or 3 hours and you're not looking at specific properties, you should be able to find something. And especially if you're open to having a non-electric site, you can usually always find something. So I think if you're just open to it and open to traveling a couple hours, really when you get on the road, going 2-3 hours is not as big of a deal as we kind of think it is, especially if you are only wanting to go for one night and jump in. There's always going to be things for you to do, and you're more likely to find something the further you're willing to go.
Well, give us a little sneak preview. Let's take it to October. Our leaves are changing around the state. For somebody who says, you know what, I'm willing to roll the dice. I don't mind shivering if it's a cold October night. Where are some great places to look at getting that October reservation?
I love visiting the Northwest in October, so I would definitely check out Pattison State Park or Amnicon State Park up in Douglas County. What, you know, you can't go wrong with waterfalls, right? So we've got the fourth highest waterfall, Big Manitou Falls, at Pattison State Park, along with Little Manitou. At Amnicon, we've got a series of waterfalls there. And what I love both, especially at Pattison, but at both of them, viewing the waterfalls is incredible in the fall with the backdrop, especially if you're a photographer or an artist. But there is the Beaver Trail at Pattison, and that trail was actually wiped out in a natural disaster in 2018 and has since been rebuilt. And that trail meanders through incredible sugar maple forest. So the bright yellow color is incredible. So I would definitely check out Pattison and Amnicon State Parks in the Northwest.
Missy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Missy Van Landit is the Recreation Partnerships Section Chief for the Department of Natural Resources.
We heard from some of the Wisconsin Today team about their favorite camping spots. Producer Beatrice Lawrence says the best place to camp is Willow River State Park on the Minnesota border. She says great waterfalls and the campsites are nice and private.
She also suggests Interstate State Park, which is pretty secluded and has some pretty cool hiking along the river. You can even catch climbers on the rocks. Beatrice says Devil's Lake camping, overrated.
Tech Director Sarah Hopeful is a big camper as well, and she says that Wyalusing State Park in the southwest part of the state is her favorite. Great views of the Mississippi River, Sarah says, and she makes it a tradition every fall.
And Dean Canetter shared that he really likes Harrington Beach State Park, especially the old quarry that's now a lake, but unfortunately, they don't let him camp there.
Let us know.
I don't know if that's just him.
Let us know about your camping spots and experiences. Get in touch on social or email. Hope to hear from you. You might have done some road tripping this Memorial Day weekend, and maybe you like to watch passing cars to see what's on their license plates. Oh, Rob, our minivan crew plays the license plate game. We're trying to get all the letters of the alphabet.
Oh, yeah, I've done that. Now, we want to know about the vanity plates you see out there, the ones that made you laugh or that you couldn't seem to crack what they meant. Do you have vanity plates? What's on them? Why did you decide to make that statement?
Get in touch with us. You can leave us a message at 888-642-0232. You can also find that number at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today, where you can email us as well.
Used to know a guy who had the vanity plate. It said vanity. We'd love to hear a little backstory about your one-of-a-kind plates, and maybe we can share it on a future show. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.